Hello, everyone, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. I'm just going to turn it over to the chairperson in just a second. I just wanted to that if you're joining us, we just ask that you can maintain a fragrance-free zone for the benefit of those with sensitivities, and also to observe Zoom etiquette, which means that if you're not speaking, please be muted, and if you're moving around, please stop your video. And everything we do here at the lodge is we stress impersonality. We're friendly, but we're impersonal. So we don't talk about personal issues and anecdotes and things like that. Okay, we'll turn it over to the chair at this point.
Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We have a volunteer who will be reading the declaration, giving the announcements, and then sharing a reading with us at this time.
Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. Work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty. Leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. Whole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists, furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise, be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. The announcements at the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia, which is located at 1917 Walnut Street. Lodge holds three weekly meetings to disseminate the teachings of theosophy. These meetings are on Sundays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. The Sunday morning meetings are based on a monthly theme. That theme is presented in the format of a forum, a lecture, or a panel discussion. The theme for October is the ancient wisdom religion. Last Sunday, the panel discussion was entitled The Secret Doctrine, Its Nature and Source. Today's lecture is entitled The Lodge of Adepts, Next Sunday, October 15th, the panel will discuss the topic, The Modern Theosophical Movement. Podcasts of these meetings can be heard at the Philadelphia website. Theosophy Hall opens at 10:30. The meeting begins at 11 and ends at 12 noon. This meeting is Zoom and on-site accessible. The Wednesday evening study class is continuing its yearly study in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. The first three classes are on the theme of masters as perfected human beings. First class focused on the answer to the question, do they help mankind? This Wednesday, October 11th, the topic is Masters, Perfected Human Beings, Historical Traces. And the concluding class on the 18th takes note of their powers and influence. And the following week, we begin with a new topic, the evolution of the cosmos. The reference library in Theosophy Hall is open on Wednesdays from 6:15 until 7:15. For those wishing to read, browse, and or ask questions about the teachings. The study class begins at 7:30 and ends at 8:45. This too is a Zoom and on-site meeting. The Friday evening roundtable discussion begins at 6:30 and ends at 7:30. The topic this past Friday was entitled, In the Light of Theosophy. An article from the Theosophical Movement magazine for February of 2022. Friday meetings are Zoom only. And the announcement for next Friday's meeting will be emailed during the week. Straight line theosophical materials mentioned may be purchased in Theosophy Hall before and after meetings. They may also be purchased from Theosophy Company in Los Angeles, California, or freely downloaded from the Phoenix, Arizona Lodge website. Lodge meetings are free and open to the public. All lodge activities are sustained by voluntary contributions of time, money, and service. Those wishing to volunteer in any way are encouraged to contact any of the lodges. All voluntary contributions are greatly appreciated. That concludes the general announcements of weekly activities at the Philadelphia Lodge. Next, there will be a reading from a compilation of articles which can be found in the book, The Great Theosophists. That we all labor together, transmitting the same charge and succession. We, few equals, indifferent of lands, indifferent of times. We, enclosers of all continents, all castes, allowers of all theologies, compassionators, perceivers, rapport of men. We walk silent among disputes and assertions, but reject not the disputers nor anything that is asserted. We hear the bawling and din. We are reached at by divisions, jealousies, recriminations on every side. They close peremptorily upon us to surround us, my comrade. Yet we walk upheld, free, the whole earth over, journeying up and down till we make our ineffaceable mark upon time and the diverse eras. Till we saturate time and eras that the men and women of races, ages to come, may prove brethren and lovers as we are. In every country and in every age, there were and there will be people pure of heart, who, conquering their earthly thoughts and the passions of the flesh, raise their spiritual faculties to such a pitch that the mysteries of being and the laws governing nature and hidden from the uninitiated are revealed to them. Let blind men persecute them. Let them be burned and hunted from societies acknowledged by law. Let them be called magi, wise men, Rajyogis or saints. They have lived and they still live, everywhere, recognized or unrecognized. For these people who have illumined themselves during their lifetime, there are no obstacles. There are no bodily ties. They do not know either distance or time. They are alive and active in the body as well as out of it. They are wherever their thought and their will carries them. They are not tied down by anything, either by a place or by their temporary mortal covering. Again, lecture for today is entitled Lodge of Adepts.
Thank you. This is a remarkable concept, and certainly the key point, the foundation in many, many ways of the ancient wisdom religion. It is a concept upon which all others hinge, and it is a series of concepts that reflect the fundamental propositions of the philosophy of theosophy. Having said that, the Lodge of Adepts, the entire notion of what it would be to be fully enlightened, is perplexing, shall we say, for the modern public. It is an unknowable proposition for many. We really can't wrap our minds around the ultimate spirituality of a fully enlightened one. And so in times when we are presented with a proposition that seems to be perplexing or unknowable, we turn frequently to the use of analogy to look into the depth of something that we know so we can transfer that thought process to something that is to be known. And immediately water and the water cycle came to mind. Water on this planet sustains all forms of life. It is recognized and known by one and all, in both its visible and invisible forms. And water, as a life sustainer, is a perfect analogy for the spiritual life sustainer that we call divine wisdom, that we know is protected, preserved, promulgated, personified by the Lodge of Adepts. So we have spiritual sustenance of life in these great ones, akin to water as the physical sustenance of life on this planet. So let's think again about three different aspects of how we know that water is true and real. The scientist starts with the first very, very abstract symbolization of the molecular components of water, H2O. And in that abstract concept, students of science can begin to imagine or can begin to reason out what it is at the atomic level, how this comes about at the molecular level, what the implications are for chemical interactions. And again, much of that is done in an ethereal state. Water is still a reality, but it is real and ideal. It is symbolic as well as physical. Then there's a second level of understanding for water that we share. There are various manifestations or states of existence for water. These are merely temporary appearances under natural law, but there's something that we can sense with our physicality. So we know water in its vapor or gaseous state. We know water in its liquid state. We know water as a solid or ice. And again, we recognize water in all forms, and we recognize that those forms appear periodically according to natural law. And finally, there is an array or a manifestation of the conditions of water, ranging from extremely pure down to something that's semi-useful, all the way down to something that's toxic. So we recognize water in its pure state, filtered or natural. We recognize water in a briny, brackish, kind of half pure, half salt state. We recognize pure brine in seawater. And we also recognize water that's toxic or polluted. Many of these conditions are man-made conditions or implied by human activity. And so there's quite an array, a range of how water could be understood at the most physical level. So in this analogy, we see something that moves our thinking from the universal through a cyclic manifestation, and then into the realm of human application in which humans interact with great nature and can maximize purity or create a great toxicity. So within these three points of understanding of water, we can find parallels to pondering this morning's talk, The Lodge of the Adepts. This topic is at once intuitive. It seems to ring a bell with many, many students, and there is knowable. And it is also a topic that is a mystery for skeptics, even if they are part of an established religion proclaiming a particular deity as the basis for their religious faith. So let's follow the same line of consideration from abstract to increasingly finite and measurable as we did in our introductory analogy. So we'll start with the unity of the concept of what it would be to be an adept or to be in a guru parampara chain of an array of adepts ranging from the most ethereal, the highest we can imagine, to those that walk among us. We see abstract ideal symbols of human evolution and universality. We see these concepts that the human spirit is perfectible, that there can be at a very, very lofty degree of spiritual evolution, tremendous thought leaders, spiritual guides, if you will. We know that there are myths and legends around the world about the beginnings of time and the role that these greatly enlightened ones played. We know that we've got historical and legendary accounts of the golden ages in which divine kings walked among men and were considered not only deities, but kingly leaders as well. And resident in most of the world religions, there is still trace evidence of lessons about the founding angels, great forces in nature that are deific. In the universal theosophic parlance, we use the notion of the Dion Shoans, and it is said at the great potential of soul as it is currently using human state to reunite with this universality, this oneness, and through effort daily to become perfectible. We see that all about us. We see these tremendous ranges of historical accounts of ethical, spiritual messiahs and leaders, teachers, all the way through a genius that appears now and then in a particular field. Or perhaps we see partial genius in which there's tremendous talent in a lesser field, but it's very, very finite, very limited. We see discernible across time and cultures without any kind of separateness that this potential for human perfectibility exists. In the 10th chapter of the Gita, a scripture that is over 5,000 years old, we see a description of Krishna as being the inner consciousness. That consciousness that is a creative solitude in universality. That consciousness that we sense as a notion of I am existence, being that spiritual force far greater than matter. And so theosophically, we have certain instructions or certain statements that we could study both individually and together, that soul emerges from the spiritual absolute in a very highly evolved, developed, abstract way. It comes forth. And that soul, in the very, very early essences of manifestation, is sevenfold. We know that there are great, great legends and myths about the Dhyani and how they come about. We can read about the role of the Nirmanakayas, those souls that in past periods of evolution have perfected themselves and can now work in and out of a body, that have mastery over all of the different conditions of existence we can imagine. And we know that soul using the correct vehicles under karmic law can appear when cycles are appropriate. When the need is the greatest, it appears that's when a reformer comes on the scene and assists in the retuning, if you will, of the human mind and heart to ethics and to proper philosophical fundamentals or foundations. It is said through much of the theosophical literature that we study that it is the seekers for the answers to the great problems of life that call these souls forth, so that as the masses of souls in the collective begin to suffer, begin to question reality, begin to question the finite teachings that they've been offered so forth, in that effort, what has happened is there is a bridge, there's a link that develops internally between the seekers and those elders that have gone before, that have bloomed in prior incarnations. We can look at sources like The Secret Doctrine. In volume one, you can find on page 272, a recapitulation, a whole statement about the nature of the wise of the fifth race and how they arise and they begin to teach in this universe without end. And again, we're envisioning always that within this soulful cohort of highly developed, highly enlightened souls, we can find a continuity, we can find an endeavor that protects humankind, that preserves divine wisdom, what we call theosophy, and that assists in the promulgation of these ideas, regardless of the changing times and cultures. The effort goes on. So that brings us to a second kind of level of the analogy we used earlier with water. In the second knowledge of water, we talked about the varying states of the varied states of existence of water in which we could still recognize that water. When we apply that thinking to something that is ideal personified, ideal realized, ideal made practical, what we come to is that there's self-consciousness in varying states resident within each and every human entity, whether in a body or out of body, whether highly evolved or tremendously conditioned and challenged. And that this self-consciousness is in potential in all states of matter, in all points of reference. And that self-consciousness, that germ, when fully invigorated, fully energized, has power over space, time, mind, matter, has power over the mental attributes of what it is to be human, over the psychic attributes, the astral attributes, the physical attributes. We can find evidence that this reality is acceptable and provable to ourselves if we think about the germ of that potential, although undeveloped in the vast majority of those in the human state right now. We see evidence of that in very mundane ways, in telepathy, in mind reading, in hypnotism. We take for granted the kind of psychic and intellectual power that's involved in a presentation like this morning, where there's one thinker trying to create and sustain ideas in a logical fashion, emitting sound, which then goes out across the airwaves, literally through the magic of Zoom, into Theosophy Hall, and far beyond. And yet, each of us as listeners can hear those sounds, can interpret the meaning, can perceive the meaning, may be able to read into more than words and in between the words and correct some of the presentation for ourselves, all the while critiquing the concept, considering the proposal and the proposition. That's the germ. That's the creative force of soul working through mind, working through the psychic, working through the physical. It is said that two minds that vibrate or change into the same state will think alike. And we see that frequently between folks that have lived together for decades, between parent and child, maybe between twins, it shows up significantly. And there we have mundane evidence that in very, very lofty states of adepthood and beyond, that two minds could vibrate together at the same tone or the same state, and therefore be aware of each other regardless of where they are on the planet. They will think alike. They will teach alike. There's a certain underlying principle that they'll be able to share between them and then emit for the rest of us. We know that in the mundane world, soul cannot be selfish or cannot live only for the present and the transitory. It just doesn't work. And frustration, sorrow, grief, often doubt will creep in. And so we can see that this impulse to be altruistic, to be of service to one and all, That is a commonality deep within the recesses of the human heart. And we can imagine a full bloom of that altruism, that self-sacrificing among those that are highly evolved. And further, the true doctrine of theosophy is said to be impacted or in an imperishable center of man's nature, and that the lodge of adepts forever and in always preserves that impress and helps to flame under natural law the power of that impress. So we have an archetypal abstract universe, an ideal upon which the subjective can be built. Very gradually, we have these teachings of the loftiest being the great architect, carrying out plans for the universe, not just for this planet, but for the entire universe. And we find traces of that essence of the purest, the highest of these adepts among Rishis or Dion Chohans or the Lords of Light. There's all sorts of allusions in teachings about the archangels or divine intelligences or the devas. All of this is in potential in the abstract at the universal level. And then coming forth from that, there is said to be a Guru Parampara chain, a whole manifestation of degrees of adeptship. The Mahatma is a personage who is specialized in training and education, has evolved high faculties, very, very high faculties, and attained spiritual knowledge that the rest of humanity can achieve as well. Comparatively speaking, there's very few. But their degree of manasic energy, another mind energy, their high manasic essence, makes them incredibly pure and makes them connected fully with the sixth and seventh principles that the rest of us are now studying about. Those Mahatmas are ideals, they are facts. They can walk among human beings when the karmic law is correct. And on the other hand, the rest of us can contemplate them. We can study about this in our private periods of study. We can discuss, as we are going to be continuing to discuss in Wednesday night ocean classes, what are the historical traces? What kind of powers might be exhibited among such a one. But having said all that, unless we ourselves are so divinely fine-tuned that we can be at one with this divine wisdom, we would not really recognize a great soul, a Mahatma, who has assumed a human mask and is walking among us, making the effort to protect humanity. They're the crown of evolution of humans. We have a limited degree of perception based on spiritual insight, and so we may not recognize fully when a master is working in the world. And having said that, under law, there's many time periods when the masters are not able to come forth and work according to karmic cycles. And that brings us to the third aspect of our analogy with water. It is all humans, all souls working in human state that can uplift conditions or can pollute conditions. We can purify or we can make something toxic. And so we see across history and time, even among us in 2024, coming up in the new year, we will see more and more effort to understand unidentified flying objects. We will see more and more effort for folks to understand what an extraterrestrial might be like. We will see probably a resurgence of 2001, The Space Odyssey. Some folks will revisit that ancient legend of Shangri-La. And as we watch that impulse in the common man, students of theosophy will sit back and say, oh, wait a minute, it's the same concept. It's the perfectibility of soul in the human state. It's the reality that there are those that are not only highly perfectible, but they have reached a fruition available and potential in this particular plane of manifestation, that there are wise men of a fifth race, that Dhyanis do exist, that there are these Manvantaric pulses, if you will. And it's the same notion. It's just that in the popular culture, masks are put on these realities. The effort to study it is external, is to find evidence of powers out there elsewhere, anthropomorphic, but not recognizing the true nature of self, that within each of us, from the elder brothers of the golden ages to the purely intuitive indigenous who live very, very close to the earth in a primitive or less industrialized manner, there is still this all-knowing, this offering of a body of a knowledge that's similar around the globe. And we find in historical periods, as we will discuss this coming Wednesday night, that there are accounts of saviors, Krishna, Buddha, Christ, a whole line of elder brothers, however they're called, initiates, adepts, the magi, the hierophants, kings of the East, the wise men, examples like the mystery schools of Greece, and modern examples of gifted humans, Abraham, Moses, Solomon, Apollonius of Tyana. And throughout all of those historical traces that we can find, throughout all of the fantasies that those who are looking for power outside of themselves, for all those fantasies that are created, as theosophy and as students, we have certain famous quotes that we can cling to. The master soul is one. That thou art. Look within, thou art Buddha. Raise the self by the self. Make theosophy a living power in life, for life and lives. Seek the bridge. The bridge are the masters. And so that takes us to the current embodiment of this concept that we're using as a title today. When you think about a lodge, there are many different meanings, from a tiny little house on a great estate, a meeting room, if you will, for mystical or philosophical purposes, often used by what's called a brotherhood. Theosophy Hall comes to mind. Masonic halls would be another example. But to lodge something also means to make or become firmly fixed, to lodge something, to embed it in a particular place. Sometimes it's used to explain leaving valuables in a very safe place, housed, if you will, valuables that are preserved. And in the 1600s, they used to talk about something being lodged so we make it stick. And so there we have the notions ranging from an outer place to an inner process of something very valuable being lodged in a heart of hearts not so much a geographic location, but in theosophic terms, in a state of mind, in a state of consciousness. And then ultimately, if we're thinking about adepts, we have in theosophy a very public statement about the life of Tsongkhapa, who pulled together a concurrence, a tremendous inbreathing, if you will, gathering of the great many Mahatmas and adepts available in 1475. In some readings outside straight line theosophy, Tsongkhapa is said to be the first Dalai Lama. But we have traces that we can study that starting in 1475, with this gathering in of these masterful ones, that thereafter, in the end of every 25 years of every century, there has always been a spiritual energy that arises. It arises in each soul using a human state, for it is lodged within. It is preserved and assisted and emitted and called forth by these working lodges or gatherings of adepts, those that are very skilled or very proficient in spiritual matters. And we know that this fraternity of perfected souls working in, especially publicly, in those last 25 years of every century, exhibit relative mastery over the different principles that they can bring under their avail. And we are advised as students that these masters, these great ones, can be known in the hollow of the head and the chamber of the heart as we meditate and work to apply our meditations in daily life. I'm sure you came this morning with your own thoughts about the Lodge of Adepts and the whole nature of masters. And we'll try not to step on the toes of those folks that are going to be leading the next couple of ocean classes. SL?
To follow up on some of the last comments made, it seems as though we can draw a correspondence between the United Lodge of Theosophists and the Lodge of the Adepts. As pointed out, the United Lodge of Theosophists exists in a physical state as a building where people can associate. But in recent years, we've used the term of the United Lodge of Theosophists as it manifests electromagnetically over the internet. It's always there, but it's only available to those who have the instrument to tune in. But it exists there and reflects itself. It also exists as a document, or at least a group of ideas expressed in the declaration. And then on, we might say, the highest spiritual plane, it exists as minds bound together by a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and an affinity to those ideas. So if we can see it even in the microcosm, we call this United Lodge of Theosophists, we can apply that same division or understanding to the Lodge of Adepts.
Excellent point. Analogies every which way. And when we think of the number of folks around the globe who are studying in isolation, they have access to these concepts because deep within their own hearts, they find them to be true. They may not even have the word theosophy. They may not know about this tremendous heritage of this Lodge of Adepts going back into the darkest recesses of time. They may have no evidence for it at all, but resident within them is this sense, this tone that I am eternal, that eternal Eternity is spiritual, it is compassionate, it is heartfelt, it is limitless. And so these profound degrees of wisdom might be developed in past lives, might be a scenario where a student who comes to the study using logic and reason and intellectual scholarly pursuits begins to find that there's something intuitive that responds to these ideas. And again, if we could find the analogy in something as close up as the United Lodge of Theosophists, then we can extrapolate on the macrocosmic level that this is also true. SL, follow up?
Now, you said that the Lodge of Adepts and its various degrees of disciples work to benefit humanity. Mm-hmm. But do they work with individuals? Do they work to help the development of individuals?
The question about are the masters there to help us is a real common question. And often it is produced because in the last 2,000 years especially, probably longer, the collective of human mind have had a tendency to create gods, put masks on the face of deific essence, and then to externalize and idealize them and pray to them. So we have this tendency in the astral, we have this tendency in individual skandhas to look for the Messiah, to look for the Savior, to pray for a miracle. And therefore, there are some, including students of theosophy, that would want the adepts to come from an external point of view and save the world, create world harmony, world peace, food for everybody, save us from crises of all kinds on an individual level. Rather, what theosophy offers us is the opportunity to experience our own karma, a crisis or a celebration, doesn't matter, to think our way through that and to begin to be reflective. How is this like what we see at large among all humans? How is this unique to the creativity of my own thinking and my own passions and desires? And in that process, as we become stronger in our conviction, more sustainable in our effort to make that understanding, what's going on, but we are playing with the tumblers on the lock of our heart until finally we get just the right combination and the heart can open up. As we begin to develop our own spiritual insights and we begin to unlock our hearts through our own self-devised and self-fulfilled methods, we become closer and closer to the ideal companion for the work of the masters. So as we volunteer, as we perfect our motives, if we will, we set about the process of unlocking the heart, setting a particular tone of vibration to the most universal oneness we can imagine. And in that stream of light, we can be in touch in our deep sleep states in particular. We can be used, according to karmic law, by a master who's attempting to work in the world. And if we look over the history of some of these great theosophists, look into the life of Jacob Burma, who had no formal education. Look into the life of Thomas Paine, if you will. Look into the life of even some creative geniuses, poets, literary writers, musicians, artists. They will talk about working themselves into a state of consciousness in which a force, a flow, if you will, seems to emit from within, but they know that personality-wise, it's not them that's generating that. Something's moving through them and being expressed. So can the masters come forth and work directly in a karmic arena like the one in which we exist, where money, power, fame, military might, political power, all of these remarkable applications of passions and desires seem to be at the forefront? Can they help directly and change all that karma? No. But can they be available, like the wind beneath our wings, to assist each of us as we work to assist the whole? It can happen. It is available when we least expect it in the most mundane of ways. Miracle working? No. No, not at all. Everything according to a self-fulfilled and self-devised application of law. Let's consider for a minute the most modern example of Blavatsky and the Lodge of Adepts. Frequently in the West, when someone's new to the study of theosophy, they immediately turn to the East as the source. And we can remember during the 1970s how many folks began pilgrimages to India, Nepal, Tibet, looking for Shangri-La, looking for that monastery place in time and space where the masters might be found, where they may find their individual guru. But if you look at the life of Blavatsky, in the late 1800s, traveling the world as a solitary woman in a time period in which she was preparing and studying, this was before 1875, did she just go to the East? The answer is no. She traveled throughout the Americas. She traveled throughout Northern Africa, Egypt in particular. She was all over Europe. And so what we're reminded that there is this universality, this shared brotherhood that is not tied to the mountains of the Andes or the mountains of Nepal and Tibet and India. It is not tied to the rolling plains of North America where the serpent mounds are, but rather this brotherhood is operating everywhere that karmic law allows it. And these degrees of wisdom are available to any one of us, wherever we're situated around the world. We can find the symbolism that teaches the universality of life, the periodicity of life, and the ultimate evolution and perfectibility of life. We can find that everywhere. All we have to do is line up the philosophies, line up the religions, look into the sciences, compare everything, and we'll begin to see the universality of teachings across time and place. MDW.
Yes. I'd like to join that lodge. But how could I? How could I become a helper? How can I create my energy in correspondence to theirs? Is there a way to do that? Or am I lost in this 2023?
Well, as we begin to think about our own aspirations, we start at a point of studying those aspirations. If I want to join the lodge, if I want to be as the masters are, if we have to be very careful which I is speaking. So we begin with a contemplative process of discerning what's the true nature of self. Is it I am spirit, or is it I am whatever incarnation, whatever personality we're using as a mask right now? So we begin the process of being reflective. And for many, it is advised that we have periods of meditation, of reflection, that's active thought, in the morning, first upon awakening, in the evening, just before we go to sleep. It's also in other readings, I notice they suggest before we take in food that we have a period of meditation. In other readings, you'll find statements about maintaining 24/7 a degree of mindfulness, of introspection, moment by moment by moment, as the hours of the day unfold. In the process of trying to pursue that, what's the true nature of self? How do I connect with that true nature of self, that spirit within? How do I try to use it on moment by moment, 24/7? Then we begin to look at, well, am I doing this to benefit I, me, my, and those people in my beloved inner circle or sphere of influence? Or do I find the impulse to be at one with all degrees of nature? Is there an impulse when I do go out into the public, to empathize, to identify with every human being around me? And so we gradually become more and more enlightened in that manner. And in that process, what's going on? Are we not already doing the master's work on this plane in the endeavor to remain rooted in true spirit, to hold that moment by moment, to use that to impress life and uplift life, to use that power, those energies, to gain insight to how can I live more ethically? How can I purify my motives? When we go to deep sleep at night, when soul blooms in deep sleep at night, it is said that we're communing with all that spiritual oneness, however we can imagine that and try to bring it into our vocabulary. And so that process, that endeavor, however humble it may seem right now, begins to unlock the tumblers of the heart and begins to set us at the right vibration. And we know that there is sympathy, telepathy, the ability to communicate, and we will find ourselves bridging from this mundane life form into a much higher reality. And the ultimate will take care of itself. Whether our goal is to be a lay chela or just a companion to try to get these ideas out so that others may be able to explore them, wherever the beginning is, we don't worry about the end. We're not attached to the reward or the fruition. Am I going to be an adept or a Mahatma or a Dhyani? That's not part of the consideration. Not at all. SL?
So it is said that humanity has never been without a friend, that the masters and adepts are continuously looking for those companions who can help them in their sacred tasks. They also say that ingratitude is not one of their faults. And so their idea is, and it's expressed, that as soon as anyone feels and begins to think and act along those lines, even the desire to come closer to them, they in a sense cross the boundary and are part of the lodge, even if it's lower degrees. how much more contact, but that's just the probationary state. They're aware of that move, but how much more contact will be at that point will depend entirely on the self-induced and self-devised effort of the individual. So just by our desiring it, we become part of it and under their notice.
The thought that comes to mind as well is that there is no special halo around the study of theosophy. You know, if you recall the words of the Declaration this morning, the true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. That a theosophist is anyone and everyone that is in the pursuit of the true service of humanity. So that really we can't say we've got a monopoly on this teaching. There's no way in any shape or form we're saying that this is the true and one and only path. Masters exist as ideals, as realities, and their availability, their power and potential can seek out and support every thinker around the globe, however they find themselves, as long as they're in the pursuit of these eternal truths and this altruistic service. And our time is up. So Wednesday night, we'll go into the historical traces that are about the Lodge of Adepts. Sure to be a good class.